Hi, I'm Dan Lothian, the executive producer for The World. I want to take a moment to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. Thank you. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round. Recurring gifts are especially impactful. They ensure we have the resources to be meaningful with our time, to ask consequential questions, and to dive deep into hard issues. It allows us to plan ahead so we can spend more time thinking about the coverage we'd like to bring you next week, next month, and even next year. We are aiming to raise $67,000 before the end of the year, and a generous donor has offered to match your gift one for one. Every gift gets us closer to our goal. Can we count on you? Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Once again, thank you. And now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
A travel ban on some Israeli settlers, that's what the White House is imposing on settlers who've been involved in attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank. We'll hear from one expert who says this makes sense.
The Israeli government has largely turned a blind eye away from these attacks. And so for the U.S. government to call it out and say that this is unacceptable and we need to take action is an important step.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today in Poland, protesters are blocking cross-border truck traffic from Ukraine.
That protest is a good thing because people don't see what's happening here.
And of beauty pageants and politics. In Nicaragua, the government says the Miss Universe contest was part of a coup plot. This critic has her doubts.
I would say that this is paranoia.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being here on this Wednesday. The Biden administration says it's imposing sanctions on several dozen Israeli citizens. The individuals have been implicated in attacks against Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken had warned that this action was coming. Attacks by Jewish settlers have been on the rise in the West Bank for the last year. Over many years, these settlements and continuing construction of them have been a major sticking point in the effort to reach a peaceful resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. To find more about the history of the settlements, we're joined by Hadar Suskind. He's the president and CEO of Americans for Peace Now and joins us from Washington. Hadar, what do you make of this decision by the Biden administration to impose visa bans on this group of Israeli settlers?
I think it's an excellent decision. I think, you know, similarly to people from any other region, from any other country, folks who are engaging in violence, who are engaging in illegal activities like that, frankly, already are by law banned from coming to the United States. But making this explicit point is an important one because the Israeli government has largely turned a blind eye away from these attacks. And so for the U.S. government to call it out and say that this is unacceptable and we need to take action is an important step.
So the group that's facing sanctions is apparently just a few dozen people. But tell us more, Hadar, about who lives in these West Bank settlements. I mean, we're talking a group of around 500,000 people, right?
You know, you can break it down into three categories. There are some developments, towns, even really cities that are over the Green Line, are in the occupied Palestinian territories, but have been treated by Israel for many, many years as territories that likely in any eventual solution will be part of Israel. You then have smaller little settlements where, you know, you may have a few hundred people living. Again, all of these settlements are illegal under international law. But then you have settlements that are illegal under even Israeli law, which are referred to as sort of the hilltop settlements. They're basically wildcat settlements where people, mostly young people, will go out from some of the established settlements and claim an area. And of course, when I say claim, it is not unowned land. They are simply physically staking out a claim and, you know, doing so at gunpoint to land owned by Palestinians.
And what has the Netanyahu government done to address those hilltop settlements that are, as you say, illegal even in Israeli law?
Little to nothing is unfortunately the answer. I mean, the truth is that many of the members of the Netanyahu government are settlers themselves, and they support that movement.
As you said, the settlements go back many years. Let's go back to how it all began. What are the origins of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank?
Well, the origins of the West Bank settlements start in 1967 after the Six-Day War, when Israel took over that territory, which had been controlled by Jordan. So shortly thereafter, by I think 1968, you began to see some settlements established. And originally, they were small. They were put in what was considered to be strategic places as, you know, a first line of defense against the threat of attacking armies. There were those who from the 60s were already arguing that the settlements were, you know, a bad policy that was going to make it more difficult for Israel to ever reach a peace agreement.
Is the idea, though, that for the settlers, that if there are more settlements, those roots stick and that would eventually be, in their view, impossible to kick them out?
Oh, clearly that's the settlers' intention, yes. And there are those who do so from sort of ideological, political positions like that, that they want to lay claim to this land for Israel. And they believe that if they are there and more of them are there, that it would be more difficult for any Israeli government to make a peace deal with the Palestinians.
For many years, Hadar, the U.S. has raised objections to the growth of West Bank settlements, and yet they've continued to grow. Is there another approach the U.S. should be taking?
Right now, there is an effort being discussed, which is the idea of conditioning aid to Israel. We give $4.3 billion in aid to Israel every year, and the government could very easily turn to the Israeli government and say, okay, here's the condition on our aid. If there are any new settlements or any settlement growth, we will reduce it by X amount. And at that point, Israel's a sovereign country. It's up to them to decide what they want to do. The U.S. can't dictate that. But we can dictate whether or not our tax dollars are going to support those things.
Hadar Suskind is the president and CEO of Americans for Peace Now. He joined us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
There's momentum at the COP28 climate summit in Dubai for an agreement to phase out fossil fuels. There's also resistance from major oil producers, including Saudi Arabia. Additionally, some developing and middle-income countries, including large parts of Africa, say they deserve to be able to exploit their natural resources and develop their economies, just as richer countries have already done. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman has a perspective from Ghana in West Africa.
I'm here in Tema, an industrial hub with machines and chimneys releasing thick plumes of black smoke into the sky. A diesel-fueled truck has just parked along the road, loaded with inorganic fertilizers. Bismarck Ousunoti is in the passenger seat. He tells me through the window that he's helping transport the fertilizer to Accra. He is with Ghana's Peasant Farmers Association.
If you look at the consumption of fertilizers in Ghana, about 80% of the fertilizers that are used by farmers are the inorganic fertilizer, which is mostly made from the natural gas and other materials.
Climate activists want inorganic fertilizers phased out due to their reliance on fossil fuels and the impact on the environment. But Ousunoti is concerned that phasing out fossil fuels now could worsen hunger in a country where 2.5 million people are severely food insecure.
If there is a plan to phase out the use of natural gas for fertilizer, then you might be creating some problems for farming.
Ghana also relies on fossil fuels for more than half of its total energy supply, and it's been producing oil and gas since major petroleum reserves were discovered in 2007. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris visited Ghana in March to pitch a green energy transition. Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, made clear in a joint press conference that he had a different vision.
I made it known to the vice president that Ghana is endowed with abundant natural resources, which my government is seeking to use as the basis to transform its economy with a vision of taking Ghana out of dependence on aid to a self-reliant economy beyond aid.
This echoes the position that some middle-income and developing countries, including many in Africa, are taking at the climate summit. And it is what I heard at this bustling fuel station in the capital, Accra, where Baba Ahmed has pulled up in a black Toyota Corolla to get some petrol.
So it's not a conversation that we should be having now.
Ahmed says he understands the environmental impact of fossil fuels, but the country is not ready.
A lot of infrastructure would have to be put in place, and the cost would also have to come down in terms of buying those electric cars. It's going to be a difficult thing to really achieve.
In the sprawling neighborhood of Ashaiman, Rose Eshen largely agrees. She is a food seller who sings to attract buyers for her boiled corn and roasted plantain.
Ever since I was a child till now, we've been using firewood and charcoal for cooking. They are easy to find, they don't cost much, and they are very effective for cooking long hours.
She intermittently rubs her eyes due to the excessive smoke and heat. Eshen says despite the cost to her health, switching to the so-called modern fuels will collapse her business.
The prices of clean gas and those kinds of things are way beyond my strength. Even my daily proceeds from this business cannot afford that. No way. No way.
Eshen says any move by the government to ban the use of charcoal or firewood should take into account the economic realities of small businesses like hers.
We will meet any such attempts with fierce resistance. If the government wants us to stop using these traditional fuels, then the president should provide us with the money for clean fuel. It is as simple as that.
That is similar to the argument Ghana, the African negotiating bloc, and other developing nations are making at the COP this week. If you want us to switch to greener energy sources, you have to pay up. President Nana Akufo-Addo has said he is concerned about the call for a phase-out of fossil fuels because they bring in significant revenue to Ghana's government.
If indeed we are being told that these resources that have helped develop other parts of the world are no longer going to be available for our development, how then do we make the transition to the new source of power and development? So we have to address the issue of financing and the resources for the climate transition in our part of the world.
Africa has 18% of the global population, but consumes about 6% of the world's energy and emits an even lower percentage of carbon emissions.
Africa cannot be held responsible for this problem.
Thus, Ghanaian energy economist at Aberdeen University, Theo Echampong. He says developed countries are more focused on global renewable energy targets while they are still subsidizing oil and gas production domestically.
But you've got African countries at the receiving end where we cannot get access to the financing and the technologies that are required to address the issue of energy poverty levels on the continent.
And in the next 30 years, the population of 1.4 billion on the continent will double, driving up energy demand even more. Echampong believes that the goal of COP28 shouldn't be solely emissions reductions, but also addressing energy security, access and affordability challenges in Africa.
And I strongly believe that oil and gas, as well as nuclear, as well as renewable, and all these other energy forms should be a core part of the energy mix of African countries.
Still, there are voices like Chibeze Ezekiel favoring a fossil fuel phase-out. He leads the Strategic Youth Network for Development in Ghana.
We can't guarantee that we'll have oil and gas forever. We can't guarantee that there'll be coal forever. and at the point they may run out. Well, then what happens?
In the last 10 years, Ghana has seen worsening drought in key food-growing areas in the north due to climate change. Deserts are spreading, and heavy rains leading to floods are washing away homes, crops, and livestock. Scientists say a phase-out of fossil fuels could help mitigate these effects. But here is the dilemma Ghana faces: how to finance development if the country abandons the exploration of recently discovered oil and gas resources. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Coming up, the farmers from Thailand who were taken captive by Hamas and what we're learning after several have been released. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 23 Thai citizens kidnapped by Hamas are now back home. Hopes are high that the Palestinian militants will soon release the remaining Thai hostages from Gaza. All were abducted on October 7th from Israel, a popular destination for Thai farm workers seeking better pay. They were held in Gaza along with more than 200 other hostages, most of them Israelis. The Thai farm workers' release follows weeks of behind-the-scenes negotiations between Thailand's government and Hamas. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following this story from Bangkok. Patrick, what have these freed workers been saying about their experience being held hostage in Gaza?
The Thai government has limited their access to media so as not to interfere with ongoing talks with Hamas. But we do have some brief statements from hostages, and most were held in dark underground tunnels in Gaza, some in refugee camps, some in safe houses with Palestinian families, and they were generally split up so they couldn't communicate with their fellow Thais. Most say they were fed adequately, given enough water. Many of them said they meditated to get through the ordeal, and they've just been coming home in waves, landing in Bangkok's main airport, all of them looking pretty shaken up, to be honest. One Thai farm worker, Uthai Sangnuan, said to the Thai media that on top of trying to readjust to normal life, all the freed hostages will still be grieving the 39 Thais who were killed by Hamas on October 7. He says, "I just want to express our grief over the other laborers who lost their lives."
We've gotten comments from some of the Israeli hostages who were freed recently. They've spoken about being mistreated by their captors. Some of the allegations are deeply disturbing. Have the Thai workers said anything about being abused by Hamas or their captors?
From what we know so far, no. There's no sign or evidence they were abused or tortured. One of the freed Thai hostages, Buntom Pankong, spoke to a Thai TV channel very briefly about his treatment by Hamas. He says, "I wasn't harmed in any way. If others were, I don't know about it." Now, he and others did say that they were often too terrified to hold down food. They were held in areas bombarded by Israeli bombs, which they could hear and feel. And they were also captives of a group that had killed other Thai people in October. We don't have any evidence yet that they were abused while in captivity.
I understand Thai officials traveled to the Middle East to secure the freedom of these workers. What did it take to get them released?
They actually established a direct line to Hamas. The Thai officials first had to go to Iran. Iran put them in touch with Hamas officials in Qatar, and they worked it out. You know, Thailand is a mostly Buddhist country, but about 5% of the population is Muslim. And that includes some very high-ranking officials and community leaders. And they just jumped right into the swing of things and took the lead on these negotiations. So politically, here in Thailand, this is seen as a diplomatic success story.
And what do we know about the remaining Thai farm workers still being held in Gaza? When could they get out?
Yeah, it's either 8 or 9. They haven't confirmed that. Because Gaza is under heavy bombardment, again, that doesn't help. The lead Thai negotiator with Hamas indicated the other 9 would be freed as soon as there's another pause in fighting. He also conveyed a message from Hamas to the Thai public, and it was, "Don't come near the Gaza border if you want to work on Israeli farms in the future. If we do another raid, we won't have time to check your passport before we take hostages, and you'll be seen as working for the enemy." So that's Hamas's message to Thailand. That said, there are still tens of thousands of Thai farm workers in Israel right now. They can make roughly $2,000 a month there. That is way more than being a farmer in Thailand. And even some of the freed hostages have said that when the time is right, they will go back to Israel for work, just not near the border with Gaza.
The World's Patrick Nguyen is based in Bangkok. Thanks very much for your reporting, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
Last month, we learned that the winner of the Miss Universe contest was...
Nicaragua! Congratulations, Nicaragua!
The big win by Shanice Palacios was a point of pride for many Nicaraguans. Now, we don't typically cover beauty pageants, but in this case, the contest has revealed a dark story in Nicaragua. The director of the country's Miss Universe franchise is being connected to a coup plot against the Nicaraguan government. Cindy Regidor is a journalist with Confidencial, a Nicaraguan newsroom in exile, and she joins the show from San Jose, Costa Rica. Tell us more about the charges, Cindy, against the director of Nicaragua's Miss Universe franchise. What is she being accused of?
Karen Celeberti, the director of the Miss Nicaragua franchise, is being charged with conspiracy, treason, and cyber crimes. These are crimes that are usually mentioned when the government is putting in jail political actors, human rights defenders, presidential hopefuls, journalists.
So elaborate a bit on this. How can cyber crimes, and in this case conducted allegedly by the head of the Miss Universe franchise in Nicaragua, be connected to a coup attempt?
I would say that these are baseless accusations because in the official note that we saw a few days ago, they don't mention any proof. But what we have here is a case of people, including Karen and her husband and her son, that were part of the massive protests in 2018 that the government describes as a coup attempt.
It is pretty stunning for these charges to be leveled against the director of Miss Universe in Nicaragua right after Nicaragua has this historic win.
I know, it's really sad because in Nicaragua, people love beauty queens and beauty pageants, and they were so happy about Shanice. And this was like one single happy story, you know, like we've had a very rough 5-year stretch where we've had lots of bad news, including all the political prisoners and the censorship of media outlets and massive exile of people. And all of a sudden we had this like really good news and it's become this really sad story and it's so unfair.
What about Miss Nicaragua herself as Shanice Palacios? I mean, she's not in the country. She's not in Nicaragua. What kind of legal trouble though is she facing right now?
I don't think that she's going to be able to return to Nicaragua, honestly. She was also part of the protests in 2018. And when she won, pictures of her in those protests resurfaced. And so I don't think that the government feels comfortable with that.
And so what does this say about the government currently in Nicaragua, that they view any criticism of them as a coup attempt?
I would say that this is paranoia. And this is because right after Shanice won that Saturday night, people took to the streets spontaneously with Nicaraguan flags. They were chanting her name and they were singing the national anthem. And this was very, very similar to what happened in 2018. They don't want any kind of protest. They want to have everything under their control. Now that people were gathering around this symbol of hope, I think that they saw it as a threat.
Beauty pageants and national politics in Nicaragua. Cindy Regidor is a journalist with Confidencial, a Nicaraguan newsroom in exile. She spoke to us from San Jose, Costa Rica. Cindy, thank you very much for your time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. Winter solstice is right around the corner, the longest night of the year. So what to do with all that darkness? Some governments are actually appointing officials to help out.
Over 100 cities around the world have, sometimes they're called night mayors, sometimes they're called, as in London, night czars, sometimes they're called night ambassadors.
Staying sane when daylight is scarce. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Washington is at a standstill over funding for Ukraine. For months now, the Biden administration has been pushing Congress to pass a supplemental funding bill with roughly $60 billion in aid for the war in Ukraine. Here's President Biden speaking from the White House earlier today.
If we walk away now, we'll only embolden other would-be aggressors. So I'm calling on Congress to do something and do the right thing, to stand with the people of Ukraine, stand against the tyranny of Putin, stand for freedom, literally stand for freedom.
Congressional Republicans, though, are standing their ground, saying they will block funding for Ukraine unless the bill also includes measures to clamp down on migration at the U.S. southern border. For more on this, we're joined by The World's Daniel Hoffman. Where does U.S. funding for Ukraine currently stand, Daniel?
So in terms of funding, since Russia's full-scale invasion, no country has provided more aid to Ukraine than the U.S. So to be specific, Congress has already allocated $111 billion in assistance, and no other country comes close to that number. So most of that money ends up going to Ukraine's military, but not all of it. Some of that funding goes to supplement Ukraine's budget, so that would be civil and economic assistance for Ukraine. And on top of that, the U.S. also gives billions of dollars in humanitarian aid. So to be clear, European countries and institutions all together have provided more aid than the U.S., but no single country provides as much as the U.S.
Right. So if the U.S. has already provided such a huge amount of money to Ukraine, why is there all this urgency from the Biden White House about this new $60 billion aid package?
So in recent months, a lot of the attention has shifted to the Middle East, but the war in Ukraine is ongoing. Russia's military is still shooting rockets and directing drones at Ukrainian cities, and this has a major impact on Ukraine's infrastructure and on its economy. Being attacked and being at war is very expensive. It takes a lot of money to keep the country running. And so even though the U.S. has already provided a lot of aid, that money is running out. Just earlier this week, the U.S. director of the Office of Management and Budget wrote in a letter to congressional leaders that, quote, "There is no magical pot of funding available to meet this moment. We are out of money and nearly out of time." So here's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan speaking earlier this week.
I believe that any member of Congress who does not support funding for Ukraine is voting for an outcome that will make it easier for Putin to prevail. That is, a vote against supporting Ukraine is a vote to improve Putin's strategic position.
Yeah, strong words there from the Biden administration. I'm curious, Daniel, as to what Ukrainians have been saying about all of this. What are you hearing?
Marco, they're not happy that this issue of aid has become part of a larger political debate in the U.S. They're advocating for bipartisan support, and they want Congress to pass this bill as quickly as possible. Yesterday, a lot of Ukrainian officials were actually meeting in Washington, and today they met with some other members of Congress making this case for assistance. And Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, said yesterday that if Congress fails to approve more aid, that creates a bigger risk for Ukraine to, quote, lose this war. But the aid isn't just for the front lines. It's also about Ukraine's ability to protect its civilians. Here's Maria Avdiyeva, a Ukrainian security expert.
Take, for example, Kharkiv, my home city, where children are studying in the metro just because the schools cannot function because the missiles from Russia can land in Kharkiv in like a minute or so. If this city would have air defense capabilities, it will make functioning of the city possible.
So that's just one example where some of that aid from the U.S. goes. There are other examples as well, like equipment for mine clearing, aid for Ukrainian refugees, helping rebuild Ukraine's energy grid, and of course, a lot of the weapons that go to the front lines.
So looking ahead to next week, Daniel, and a crucial summit, EU summit in Brussels, there seems to be some turmoil in the European Union as well regarding its support for Ukraine. What's going on there?
So in that summit next week, there are going to be meetings discussing the EU's long-term budget plans. So in that proposed budget, the EU is looking to commit $50 billion of aid to Ukraine. Also on the agenda is EU enlargement. Ukraine, for a long time, has wanted to become a member of the EU, and it has already been granted candidate status last year. However, like in the U.S., there's some disagreement in the EU over some of these issues related to Ukraine. Mostly, there's been pushback from Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. So we'll be watching next week to see if the EU could strike a deal with Orban to get out of this gridlock.
The World's Daniel Hoffman, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The Russian president doesn't travel abroad very often, but today Vladimir Putin visited two countries in the Middle East, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Tomorrow, Putin will be back in Moscow, where he's hosting the president of Iran. For more on the Russian leader's agenda in the Middle East, we turn to Anna Borchevskaya. She's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. What is Putin trying to accomplish, Anna, with his visit today to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia?
There's two parts to this visit. First, there's the optics of it, and then second, the more practical implications. First, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia are non-signatory to the International Criminal Court. And of course, the ICC seeks out Putin's arrest for deportation of Ukrainian children from Ukraine. So more from a symbolic perspective, Putin is thumbing his nose at the United States and showing that he's not a pariah on the international scene. But also from a practical aspect, he is looking to have more concrete discussions about business, trade, in particular oil, and potentially other areas of cooperation with these two countries.
Right. So I want to get into what each side in this dialogue offers the other. But first, looming over Putin's visit is the war between Israel and Hamas. What does that mean for Russian interests in the region?
Well, on October 7th, a cardinal break has occurred in terms of how Putin has approached the Middle East. In other words, Putin has cultivated an image of somebody who is a peacemaker, a mediator, somebody who could talk to all sides, typically conflicting sides. And periodically, Putin has offered his mediation. But what is striking in his response to the Hamas attack is that he did not condemn Hamas. The first words he uttered after the horrific terrorist attack was blaming the United States for its Middle East policies. And that in and of itself speaks volumes. And overall, if we take the grand scope of how he responded, it shows that he is siding with Hamas more than with Israel. In other words, he's no longer neutral. At the same time, however, he still has ties to all of these important countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Hamas, which is an Iranian proxy. And in the context of the war in Ukraine, which remains Putin's priority, remember, he casts it as an existential battle that Russia is fighting. The Middle East has been an important arena of what he perceives as geopolitical competition. So he continues to cultivate ties with all these important countries.
So if this is coming up in Putin's conversations with the UAE and Saudi Arabia, how much daylight is there when it comes to where they stand on the Israel-Hamas war?
What's important is that both the UAE and Saudi Arabia have been key participants in international efforts to negotiate a potential settlement in the Israel-Hamas war. Both of these countries are important regionally in that regard at present. And Putin also has cultivated personal ties with both rulers of these countries. In fact, when he was greeted at the UAE, the leader described Putin as a friend.
Anna, returning to the economic interests in these meetings, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia, of course, are big global oil producers, just like Russia. What does Putin want from them when it comes to oil exports?
Putin is interested in making sure that oil prices remain high. Keep in mind that particularly since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia remained at best neutral on the war in Ukraine and have resisted American pressure to pressure Russia. For example, Saudi Arabia did not change its oil output, contrary to the request of the Biden administration. And overall, bilateral trade between Russia and the UAE in particular has grown significantly after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So all of these countries are interested in keeping oil prices high. What is significant, however, is that counterintuitively, after OPEC Plus announced cuts, oil prices have dropped. And that is not good news for either of these countries.
After today's two-country visit in the Gulf, Putin meets with Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi. What's that meeting going to be about?
From what was announced publicly about that meeting, there's going to be a discussion of economic cooperation in the political realm. But what I would be interested in watching is whether or not there are going to be any potential agreements when it comes to arms transfers. Remember that Iran has been instrumental in Russia's war on Ukraine, particularly when it came to Iranian drones that have helped the Russian military terrorize Ukrainians. But more broadly, the relationship between these two countries has had a far more strategic character that transcended the military realm. So I would be looking for all of these different points of cooperation and discussion.
Anna Borchevskaya specializes in Russia's policy toward the Middle East at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you very much for being with us, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
For this next story, we're going to the border between Poland and Ukraine. Over the past month, demonstrators in Poland have been blocking commercial traffic going in and out of Ukraine. The backups of trucks at the border are now miles long. Tempers are short, and perishable food inside those trucks is rotting. Polish protesters are unhappy with the European Union. The EU has put wartime rules in place that, according to many people in Poland, favor Ukrainian truck drivers by allowing them to move goods more cheaply than Polish drivers. This week, negotiators made some progress, and a few trucks have been let through. Nevertheless, resentment is still growing, as reporter Katie Toth discovered when she traveled to one border town in Poland.
When Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine nearly 2 years ago, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees landed here, in the Przemyśle train station. And it's still a transport hub for people going in and out of Ukraine today, with a rush of people catching buses and trains. Around the corner in Przemyśle's old town, the scene is much quieter. Snow has sunk between the cobblestones and it slides off the church spires. There's a holiday concert in the town square. Zgigniew Skórka is walking through the old square with a friend. I stopped to ask him about the protests on the border. He tells me he's just an observer watching it play out on the news, but apparently the law isn't working the way it should because of the number of people who decided to strike. And he says the drivers believe something's unjust, that drivers from the other side of the border are treated better by the European Union. Many in Poland say the looser trade rules imposed by the European Union in Brussels, intended to help Ukraine, are unfair to Poles. Agnes is an office worker who only gave her first name because she wanted to avoid scrutiny in this small community. She moved back to Poland about a year ago from the UK, and she says at first she didn't understand why people in her hometown get so worked up about things like this.
I say, why are you angry? You have house, you have home, you have everything. Why are you angry? Now I understand, yeah.
Now she's angry too.
I have a heart all weeks because, you know, work, child, everything. And I don't have enough money because, you know, bills and electric, everything is high because from that coronavirus, yeah? And people don't have enough money to survive.
After the war started, Ukrainian truckers were allowed to drive in and out of the EU without the usual permits. Cutting the red tape was supposed to make it easier to get supplies into Ukraine. But Polish drivers say Ukrainian drivers started moving goods within the European Union instead of just driving in and out. In other words, taking away their business. Agnes says politicians don't understand the resentment that can build when you're struggling, but you see others getting a boost.
That protest is a good thing. It's a good thing because people don't see what's happening here.
Karol Wilczynski is a researcher on integration and migration at Jagiellonian University in Krakow. He sees Poles and Ukrainians being pitted against each other.
I think Polish truckers have some rights. There is a privilege of Ukrainian truckers. The problem is how to protest in a way that will not fuel anti-Ukrainian sentiments. And unfortunately, I believe that anti-Ukrainian sentiments are growing.
Wilczynski says the state must invest in social services as more Ukrainians make a home in Poland. Otherwise, the backlash will continue.
The Polish health system, Polish educational system is drowning because they are having extra clients, but they are not helped enough by the government. I think we'll see more protests like this as the war continues and after the war, because there is no sustainable migration and integrational policy.
Przemyśl is a case study of how a war can both spark empathy and reveal its limits. The president of Ukraine gave this city an award for helping Ukrainian refugees. But Przemyśl's mayor was also voted in as part of a far-right group that, before the war, called for a Trump-style wall to be built on Poland's border with Ukraine. In the last parliamentary elections, this area was also a stronghold for the outgoing Law and Justice Party. That's a conservative party which supported Ukraine against Russia, but also stokes fears of foreigners.
We are some society which lived for last 8 years under the rule of populists. We are not ready for this kind of a challenge. And to get ready, we need a lot of education in media by politicians.
For now, Polish politicians are calling on Brussels to change the laws in order to protect their drivers. The EU and Ukraine say that's a non-starter. Meanwhile, Ukraine's deputy economy minister says the protests could cost his country 1% of its GDP growth this year. And winning a war costs money. For The World, I'm Katie Toth in Przemyśl, Poland.
On Monday, we reported that people in Jordan are boycotting McDonald's and other American brands to express their anger over U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. Today, McDonald's didn't seem to notice. They announced global expansion plans that are unprecedented, even by McDonald's own standards. The goal is to have 50,000 restaurants in operation worldwide by the end of 2027. That would mean adding 10,000 new burger joints. Most of the new Golden Arches locations will be overseas, with the greatest number in the People's Republic of China. Coming up, how does your city rank when it comes to its livability at night? Just ahead, we look at what difference a nighttime mayor can have in getting a city to function well 24/7. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Now that we're well into the last chunk of the year, night falls a lot earlier across much of the planet. Some of us just want to stay inside, but for many, that's either not possible or simply no fun. It's those hours between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. that have been getting greater attention from local governments. The World's Bianca Hillier explains.
Years before the pandemic, Amy LeMay ditched the traditional office life and 9-to-5 working hours.
I'm a woman who has always worked at night. You know, they say you're either a lark or an owl. I'm definitely an owl.
In fact, her career demanded it. LeMay ran nightclubs in London for decades. So when City Hall sought a night czar in 2016, LeMay knew she was fit for the gig. She's been in the position ever since.
My job really is to level up the night.
As night czar, LeMay wears a lot of hats. She talks with restaurant and club owners to hear what obstacles they're facing and helps put on events in town centers to activate the economy. She also walks around speaking with regular people who are out and about at night.
My team always jokes like, oh, Amy just likes chatting to people at bus stops when they're getting on the night bus, because I often find out all the really important information about what's going on in people's lives and the challenges that they face.
Amsterdam is credited with creating the gig in 2012. Since then, the idea has really taken off, says Will Straw, a professor who studies nighttime industries at McGill University in Montreal.
Over 100 cities around the world have, sometimes they're called night mayors, sometimes they're called, as in London, night czars, sometimes they're called night ambassadors.
Straw says that, especially post-pandemic, cities are eager to attract tourists and bring in more money.
And it's not just Europe and North America, it's in Latin America, it's in Asia, and so on.
Straw says priorities for night czars and night mayors are not one size fits all. For example, in Mumbai, one of the biggest problems is women's safety at night.
There's a whole series of initiatives, everything from getting more women cops to increased transport options.
Whereas in Montreal, Straw helped advocate for an experiment that allowed nightlife businesses to stay open later. The companies brought in more money with no increased threat to public safety.
There's no more sense of danger. There's no more rowdiness. There aren't really any more neighbor complaints.
And if there were neighborhood noise complaints, Straw says someone like a night mayor could try to get city funding for businesses to better soundproof their venues. Amy LeMay in London says she's constantly looking to her counterparts around the world for inspiration.
We talk to each other all the time. You should see our WhatsApp group. I think we've got representations from like an insane number of cities and countries around the world.
Ottawa is hoping to join that conversation. Canada's capital approved its first nightlife economy action plan earlier this year and is planning to hire what they call a night commissioner soon.
It's essential for thriving cities to have that nightlife economy.
Emmanuel Ray works for the City of Ottawa and helped write its new night plan. He says a citywide survey showed that residents are looking for things to do after dark.
Over 80% of respondents found that a good thriving nightlife was an important part of their quality of life.
Ray says the city plans to address that head on, in part by building more mid-sized venues for events and live music.
Whether they're doing a tour or bringing a theatrical production, we want global talent to be able to invest in Ottawa and see Ottawa as a great destination that they must stop at.
But to do that, Ottawa needs to rebrand and move away from a nickname that it just can't seem to shake. It's called the City That Fun Forgot.
If you're looking for things to do at night, it can feel like there's not a lot going on because you might be walking and not seeing people.
Eamon Jaffrey lived in Ottawa for almost 20 years. She recently moved just across the river to Gatineau. In 2014, Jaffrey produced a documentary exploring why Ottawa has such a bad rap.
Ottawa is this kind of nowheresville.
It feels old and stodgy. Yeah, it just doesn't, it's not lively. Like, it's the nation's capital, but I don't feel like there's a lot of culture. Like,
Jaffrey says certainly not everyone agrees with the moniker, but in her opinion, the nickname still stands. And she thinks a nightmare could help.
I think the biggest thing for a nightmare should be to not make it a bureaucratic exercise.
She hopes whoever governs Ottawa's night will really listen to business owners and make it easier for them to advocate for their needs. And if only they could change Canada's freezing temps and early sunsets.
That would be the key to the nightmare is please, please figure out something for the winter. Help us get out of the house in the winter.
The City of Ottawa is writing up their night commissioner job description now and plans to hire someone next year. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Time now to go to the movies.
Hungry? Thirsty? The refreshment stand is open.
Munching on snacks at the cinema is not just an American tradition.
Baffle popcorn de Balzen. C'est léger, léger, léger. Baffle popcorn de
Balzen. C'est très bon à crème
levée. Cinemas most everywhere rely on sales of candy, popcorn, and drinks. Theater goers routinely complain about the expense.
The prices that they charge inside the cinemas are just crazy.
The World's Jerry Haddon is in Spain. A consumer affairs council in the Basque region just ruled that a local theater cannot ban customers who bring their own snacks to the show.
Most Spaniards, and I include myself among them, didn't know that you couldn't bring food into the theater. I mean, it's just what everybody seems to do, at least in Barcelona, where I live. People bring in beers, people bring in sandwiches.
And that leads to complaints.
Number one, make sure it is not a smelly food.
The World's Halima Gikandi goes to the movies in Nairobi.
It should not be a whole meal that you're bringing into the movie theaters. Another rule I would say is be mindful of how loud the sound you're making is when you're eating.
If people want to go and eat, like, just go to a restaurant.
The World's Orla Barry prefers theaters that do not sell food, not even popcorn.
Those are the movie theaters that I go to because it just drives me so mad listening to someone munching and crunching and slurping away behind me. It's just, what's the point of going to see a film?
But Orla sits in the minority.
I wholeheartedly support the right to snack in movie theaters, period.
If I were to leave a film without the grease from buttered popcorn on my fingers, I didn't have the full experience of going to the movies.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
That is the end of our feature today. Thanks to Jerry, Halima, and Orla for their thoughts on movie food where they live. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Hi there. Just a moment before you go. We know that there are so many competing requests for your time and resources right now, especially as we head toward the end of the year. So thank you for being with us day in and day out as we deliver the best in international journalism with nuance and care. We are grateful to count you among our listeners. Your notes of support are a bright spot in our day. Thank you. If you haven't yet, there is still time to give. And as we head into 2024, your support is more important than ever. So if you can, I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.